Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International says TPLF fighters raped women in Ethiopia's Amhara region.
We interviewed 16 survivors of sexual and gender-based violence in a town in the Amhara region that had been taken over by the TPLF in mid-August this year. And what we documented was gruesome sexual violence attacks against these women.
Somalia and the African Union discussed the future of AMISOM. A green business college tackles South Africa's hunger and unemployment. We'll have a conversation this morning with a presidential candidate in the Gambia. Gold mining in Burkina Faso becomes increasingly dangerous, and Mozambique's former finance minister will stand trial in the United States.
The former minister has been accused of international crimes, and therefore he should go and face the charges. I also think it's very important to know that he's innocent until proven guilty.
And Ghanaian authorities try to save endangered monkey species. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International says fighters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, raped, robbed, and assaulted women at gunpoint in the town of Nefas Milcha in Ethiopia's Amhara region during an attack on the town in mid-August this year. Vanessa Sahaya is the Horn of Africa campaigner for Amnesty International. She says the Ethiopian government must facilitate immediate and unhindered access to all areas of northern Ethiopia impacted by the conflict.
We interviewed 16 survivors of sexual and gender-based violence in a town in the Amhara region that had been taken over by the TPLF for 9 days in mid-August this year. And what we documented was gruesome sexual violence attacks against these women. And this included women who had been raped at gunpoint, who had been robbed and subjected to physical and verbal assaults by the fighters. There's also been medical facilities in the town that have been destroyed and looted. And again, a majority of the survivors that we interviewed were also gang raped, and some were raped in front of their family members, including their children.
So your report said that the TPLF fighters, they not only rape their victims or the alleged victims, also they looted the victims' houses?
Yes, so there were incidents of looting and, you know, them being robbed of personal belongings and food and other items from their houses after the rapes had occurred as well.
You also mentioned health impact on these alleged victims. Can you describe that for us?
Of course. 15 of the 16 survivors that we spoke to described suffering physical and mental health problems as a result of the attacks. That's the mass majority of the survivors, and you know, described a variety of symptoms, including back pain, bloody urine, difficulty walking, anxiety and depression. And because of the looting and the destruction of the hospital and health station in the city, in the town, it was very difficult for the survivors to seek support, and they have not received the support. The majority of the survivors have not received the support that they need. Only two of the women that we spoke to have, and they were able to seek private medical treatment, but the others have not so far.
Did you reach out to the TPLF fighters about your report and these allegations?
Yeah, so we always share our research findings with whoever we're accusing of any violations. And if we hear back, we will always include it in the reports in some way. And if we haven't heard back, then there's nothing really to include. There has been a response from the TPLF that questions our methodology, but invites an independent investigation of the events. So,
what sort of help are these people getting, these alleged victims, from what organization? The Ethiopian government? Which group is helping?
So right now, the regional government in Amhara have said that the residents of Nefas Mapka, including rape survivors, have received livelihood support since the attack. This is, you know, general livelihood support after like the attack from the TPLF. And they're planning to prepare a restock of medical equipment and other supplies to the looted hospital facilities in the region, and to provide counseling and psychosocial services to survivors. These are intentions that they're hoping to do. However, it's quite difficult right now because of security issues. There's an NGO, for example, that we spoke to that normally provides these kind of services to rape survivors, and they said that they're not able to access the area due to security concerns prompted by the government's hostile public statements about international humanitarian organizations. And this kind of hostile environment that has been created by the Ethiopian federal government for NGOs and humanitarian partners, organizations in the region, has made it really difficult for them to operate. This is also restricting these survivors' access to post-rape care. But right now, again, there's intentions from the regional government to provide more support. And of course, this has to be supported by the federal government. And they need to speed up any effort to support them, both sexual violence survivors in this town, in the region, in the country, but also any other victims of this conflict.
Vanessa, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you for having me.
Vanessa Saheya is the Horn of Africa campaigner for Amnesty International. She was speaking with us from London. A court in South Africa ruled on Wednesday that former Mozambican finance minister Manuel Chan should be extradited to the United States instead of returning him to Mozambique. Chan is accused of involvement in criminal offense amounting to $2 billion. Also in Mozambique on Wednesday, President Felipe Nyusi dismissed the defense minister Jaime Neto without explanation. Neto oversaw Mozambique's response to the Islamist insurgency in the country's Cabo Delgado province. Martina Perino is a Mozambican with the U.S.-based Democracy International. She says while former Finance Minister Chan has the right to a fair trial, he must, at the same time, answer to the allegations against him.
I think it's a very significant ruling. It really demonstrates that South Africa is behaving according to their laws and constitution. And I think that's a very important sign of rule of law and abiding by the rule of law in Southern Africa. I think the former minister has been accused of international crimes, and therefore he should go and face the charges. And he has the right to a fair trial, and I strongly believe he will have it. I also think it's very important to know that he's innocent until proven guilty. And therefore, I look forward to seeing how the trial evolves and then what the court decides.
The South African Justice Minister has said that the former finance minister should be sent back to Mozambique. What is the difference between him coming to the United States and being sent back to Mozambique?
The Mozambican government has requested for him to be extradited to Mozambique. The former minister is being accused also in Mozambique of alleged corruption and other crimes. He also has a pending case in Mozambique. Well, however, the case in the U.S. started first. So it's pretty common that he should go and face those charges first. He might still be found innocent in the U.S. and then he'll have to travel back to Mozambique. At that point, he can definitely stand trial in Mozambique. And I would look forward to that.
How much money are we talking about?
We are talking about a $2 billion loan that was contracted in a non-conventional manner, not in line with our rules and regulations and legislation. $2 billion is really significant for Mozambique. The amount itself, if you think that the GDP when this was contracted was $11 billion, you can imagine that $2 billion are very consequential for the country.
Let's go to this other breaking news on Mozambique. That President Nyusi has fired the defense minister, Jaime Neto. Is that his name? What do you make of that?
It's very interesting development. Minister Neto doesn't have an extensive experience in the defense sector. He was previously a member of parliament of Frelimo, the ruling party, and he was appointed to minister of defense. I think the timing is very interesting. I would love to, I really wish the government of Mozambique would sit down with journalists and explain their rationale. I would love to understand the president's rationale and why he made this decision. It's important to note that nobody else has been appointed. It seems that he was dismissed yesterday. So I think it's a very important position to be Minister of Defense in Mozambique, as we are in conflict. One of the provinces of Mozambique is engulfed in a conflict for the past years. So it's a very important role.
Martina, I mean, as you said, the president did not give a reason for removing the defense minister. But since he was defense minister when the war against the Islamists started, could it be that maybe he is being fired because he did not do a good job?
I believe Minister Neto was appointed in January 2020. The war in Cabo Delgado escalated during his watch, yes, or the conflict in Cabo Delgado escalated during his watch, but it really started in 2017. But I'm not sure what the implication and how responsible he is for that escalation.
Martina, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us on Daybreak Africa.
Have a good day.
Martina Perino is a Mozambican with the U.S.-based Democracy International. She was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. A 15-member team of the African Union Peace and Security Council met with senior Somali officials in Mogadishu on Tuesday this week and discussed the future of AMISOM peacekeeping operations. Tensions are running high after the Somali government expelled an AU deputy special envoy last week. Mohamed Kahia reports from the capital, Mogadishu.
The federal government of Somalia and the African Union peacekeeping mission, AMISOM, have been at loggerheads over proposed reconfiguration of the 14-year-old peacekeeping force. Under the proposal, more countries will send troops into Somalia to join the 20,000 already contributed by six AU members. The Somali government is against bringing more foreign troops into the country. Meeting with the visiting AU delegation in Mogadishu on Tuesday, Somali Foreign Affairs Minister Mohamed Abdul Razak said the government rejects the so-called hybrid option.
The hybrid option that you chose brings more troops, while the STP that we would like to have reduces the current force. This is the biggest difference we have. We want less force, not more. We want a much more effective approach to combating terrorism and strengthening Somali force.
Ambassador Mohamed Gad of Egypt, who led the delegation from AU headquarters, reiterated the continental body's commitment to enhancing stability in Somalia, despite the difference over the mission.
The physical presence of the council in its full composition at this moment in Mogadishu is an expression and the commitment of the Peace and Security Council to Somalia, to the engagement of the African Union and its mission, AMISOM, at this critical juncture.
Last week, Somali officials expelled an AU deputy special envoy, accusing him of activities incompatible with the mandate of AU mission in Somalia and the country's security strategy. AMISOM was set up in 2007 to help the Somali government withstand the threat posed by militant groups such as Al-Shabaab. The mission is operating under the United Nations mandate that runs out on December 31st. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 11th. Like many nations hit by COVID-19, South Africa has seen rising unemployment and hunger since the onset of the pandemic. For VOA, Linda Giftage in Johannesburg reports that one school, the Green Business College, is tackling those issues in innovative ways, giving people the skills to not only grow their own produce, but make money to help their families and build their careers.
At a community center east of Johannesburg, more than 24 students are learning skills that would have been common among their grandparents' generation. The Green Business College is teaching them the basics of organic gardening and food preservation by making jams and sauces. For some, it is expanding on hobbies they discovered while in pandemic lockdown. It is also feeding their entrepreneurial aspirations. Onkopotse Seleka founded the company Uncle OG's Jams.
It's a lost art completely. Most of my peers around my age, they'd rather buy than make. I want to probably get to a point where that I can make a sustainable living from preserving marula fruit.
Making an empire of his late grandmother's jam recipe would be a major career change for the 32-year-old who currently works for a sporting apparel retailer. Other students are hoping the skills will simply get them into the workforce. More than 30% of South Africans are jobless. College CEO Machapiso Makabane believes the school's courses, which include beekeeping, can inspire people to create their own employment opportunities while addressing issues that come with poverty.
They say, give a man a fish, you have fed him for the day. Teach him how to fish, you have fed him for a lifetime. It's all about power. Take back your power and use it where, invest it in your soil is going to benefit you so that people can come and buy from you and buy health.
South Africa suffers from what experts call a double burden of malnutrition, experiencing extremes of both hunger and obesity. Small farms like the one set up by the college are viewed as part of the solution to providing healthy food to communities. Lisa Corsten is a plant pathology professor at the University of Pretoria.
We believe in shifting people, their whole diet to consuming more fresh produce, to produce more food within their communities. And then obviously a look at food gardens. That to us will be a very important critical element of South Africa's mindset. Produce your own food as well, and not only rely on the food system.
More than 120 students have studied at the main college in downtown Johannesburg in the past year, while many more have participated in workshops around South Africa. Graduates have used their creativity to expand beyond selling vegetables and jams. Tsipitso Moloi's line of hot sauces include a pineapple-infused variety and a ghost pepper sauce with an extreme kick.
It starts as a hobby, and then how do you then graduate that hobby into a business that you can live out of? But I wouldn't have been able to have had the knowledge around preservation that I got from the school. I wouldn't have had the momentum to keep it going, because that mentorship and coaching keeps you on the alert.
And in less than 4 months since launching, she's had two butcher shops request her products for their shelves. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Gambia's presidential election campaign is kicking off, and Abdoulaye Ibrahima Jammeh is one of the six candidates in the race. Jammeh, from the National Unity Party, spoke to Ricky Stryak about his platform.
They want to have a party that no one will claim ownership of, and actually look for a leader, and they thought they found the right leader in me. My personal motivation is I think this country can be better than it is. There are a lot of opportunities, especially if you have the right governance environment and structure in place, and you have the right people in politics. I believe that, you know, we can move this country forward.
What kind of policies do you support?
We believe that in order to be food self-sufficient, we have to put a lot of emphasis on agriculture, and that we're naturally endowed as a country. There is a river that splits the country into two, and most of it is good water. So agriculture should not just be rain-fed or depending on rainfall. We think we should be able to apply irrigated agriculture. And of course, you know that FAO did say that in Africa, only 6% of farming in Africa depends on irrigation, and I think that's appalling, because farming or agriculture depends on water, not on rainfall. We're also looking at healthcare, because we think the situation is very appalling in this country. If you have the opportunity to visit the hospitals, it's really very sad. I mean, there was footage circulating on social media one time about the accident and emergency of one of the main referral hospitals in the country, and that is the Edward Francis Small Teaching Hospital, formerly called RVTH, and you can find people just spreading mats on the floor. I mean, patients, you know, we think that's just really appalling. And of course, we know about the situation of a woman and pregnancy. Pregnancy is almost becoming a death sentence. There's a lot of mortality relating to that as well. So it's quite a range of problems that we really need to address as a country.
How do you think that your party would be able to address those financially speaking? Would you guys maybe have more of a tax base?
We think the government structure is it's too elaborate. We're thinking of seeing how we streamline to make certain savings on the government itself, the structure of the government. But we also believe that we can enhance revenue through taxation, first by bringing down the corporation tax to get a lot of people invest in the country. But we also believe that we can enhance compliance, you know, to tax, because we know there are a lot of leakage in the system.
That was Abdoulaye Ibrahima Jammeh, candidate for the National Unity Party in Gambia's upcoming December presidential election. You are speaking to Ricky Stryak from Banjul. Terror attacks on gold mining operations in Burkina Faso are becoming a regular occurrence. For VOA, reporter Henry Wilkins looks at the impact that the attacks are having on the lives and survivors and what it could mean if extracting gold, the country's primary source of income, becomes too dangerous.
Bakari, whose name has been changed to protect his identity, is a survivor of the Yergo massacre. The attack by an unknown terror group in June this year targeted a small informal gold mining site like this one and killed at least 160 people, mostly mine workers.
The country is free and all
Bakari was hiding on the roof of a building from where he could see women and children moving around. At first, he thought they were being kidnapped by the attackers and then realized they were carrying out the attacks themselves. When they finished shooting, it was around 4:30 a.m. and they started to burn buildings and vehicles, he says. Burkina Faso is the fastest growing producer of gold in Africa. While informal mining is estimated to employ and indirectly support about 3 million people, large-scale commercial mining by foreign companies brought in $300 million of revenue for the government in 2018. But as groups linked to the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda and bandits have stepped up attacks on miners, extracting gold is seen as increasingly dangerous. Since August, there have been two attacks on convoys belonging to IAM Gold, a company headquartered in Canada, and another one on a convoy owned by Endeavour Mining, headquartered in the Cayman Islands. The attacks left six dead. Salam, whose identity we have also protected, survived an assault on a mining convoy on the same route in 2019. He played dead as terrorists killed 40 of his colleagues. He now works for a different company, but says that many of his colleagues are wary of the mines. They no longer want to take the convoys along the road to the mine because it has become dangerous. He says that after the last attack, military police were able to kill two terrorists. The terrorists are going to want revenge. They're going to want revenge, he says. In recent weeks, mining companies in Burkina Faso have begun transporting local employees to mines by air instead of by road. Previously, only foreign staff flew to the mines. But some logistics still must be done by road. Liam Morrissey, CEO of MS Risk, a security consultant that works with mining companies operating in Burkina Faso, said the attacks could spell trouble for the industry.
The producing mines have regular convoy activity to keep their mines supplied, crew rotations, consumables, spare parts, plant and equipment, and so on. So we have seen, correspondingly with this spike of incidents through the wet season, we have seen incidents involving convoys. Now, they haven't been devastating, not yet.
Asked if deteriorating security might force some companies to pull out of Burkina Faso, Paul Melly of London-based Chatham House said no, at least not for the time being.
Burkina Faso is now one of the most important gold-producing countries in Africa, and the a large number of investors who've come in over recent years and the large number of mines that have opened up point to the economic attraction. So I don't imagine that companies would take a decision to pull out very easily.
Analysts say major disruption to the gold mining industry could have far-reaching impacts for the already fragile state. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Busse, Burkina Faso.
Authorities in Ghana are trying to save an endangered monkey species from extinction. Authorities say human activities are destroying the habitats of the white-naped Magabi monkeys that only live in a few parts of West Africa. Victoria Amunga reports.
At the Accra Zoo in Ghana, a worker is feeding some of the few remaining white-naped Magabi monkeys. 18 of these monkeys found homes in this zoo after their habitat in the wild was destroyed. Authorities say human activities such as deforestation and mining are significantly reducing the population of this species in Ghana. Stephen Tamanja is the manager at the Accra Zoo.
Environment or the habitat of animals we have are affected by human activities. That is just an example. Other attributes could be there. And so sometimes It forces the animals to lose some of their habitats.
Wildlife Vets International, a charity organization providing veterinary support to international wildlife, found that by the end of October 2020, there were only an estimated 1,000 white-naped Magabi monkeys in the wild globally. The monkeys are called white-naped Magabi because of their gray body, white collar, neck, and red crown physical features. Activists are pressing the United Nations to adopt animal welfare as one of its focal activities in the same manner the world body focuses on protecting human rights and maintaining international peace and security. The goal, advocates say, is to enforce protection of endangered animals, especially in parts of Africa where animals are treated poorly. The white-naped Magabi monkeys were once spread in Ghana, Ivory Coast and Burkina Faso, but they are now only found in isolated pockets of forests. Ghanaian authorities hope the recovery efforts will help increase their numbers in the near future. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Accra.
And that's it for this Thursday, November 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington.